offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam, Mananam, Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari Shankar. We are here to continue with the 13th and the final discourse in the 1991 Samako series. We had a small break last week because one of us were not available. But here to continue, I think we've played two clips so far. This is pretty much a beautiful summary of this entire series of discourses on the Upanishads. The discourse is entitled Dharma and Indian Spirituality. Before we summarize some of the points that Swami has made so far, and before we play the clip for this week, I invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Sairam Hari.
Sairam Prem.
And as we were seeing, this is a very beautiful discourse where I think Swami is talking about what the Indian culture stands for, not necessarily in its esoteric teachings. And I think the Upanishads pretty much summarize that. What is the philosophy of the Indian culture when it comes to looking at the world, when it comes to observing individuals, the relationship between an individual and the divine aspect and the rest of creation. I think that beautiful concept of oneness, which Swami would say symbolizes Vedanta. Swami spoke about how the various Upanishads spoke about it. But this particular discourse, Swami is highlighting another aspect of Indian spirituality, which I think is more practical and which is something we can pick up and start practicing right away. It's almost like with all of that knowledge in your intellect, when it comes to everyday practice, this is how it should reflect. Mm-hmm. And that is a perfect example and reflection of Indian culture itself.
Right.
And Swami started off with that beautiful padyam. Actually, I think three or four padyams, one after the other, where Swami highlighted what are those things about Indian culture which stands out. And the first thing which Swami spoke about is patience and forbearance being the greatest virtue. That was the first point Swami made. And then Swami said the sweetest thing that you can see is the love of a mother. And then Swami said the most important thing that you can have is the honor, or what you call self-respect. So I think that first padyam Swami highlighted these three things. Forbearance.
And also truth is the highest penance.
I'm sorry, I missed that out. Yeah. Truth is the highest penance.
Yeah.
And so Swami said forbearance is the greatest virtue, and truth is the highest penance among all disciplines, and sweetest is that of mother's love, and honor is more important than life itself. I think that was how Swami started the first padyam, and we've, I think, spoken extensively about that. One really wonders, if not for forbearance, even the Indian society will not be standing together, given the numbers we are living in.
Correct.
You know, close to 1.2 billion.
The diversity,
right?
Inequity that is present.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, I think in the previous discourse, Swami made that mention. What is required is not tolerance, but acceptance which comes from the fact of oneness.
Mm.
I think that's what Swami is highlighting here, because when you talk about Indian culture, from the backdrop of that oneness, the expression of acceptance must come.
Right.
Which is based on forbearance.
Also that, I just noticed when you read it out that when you said truth is the highest penance, there's that connotation that it is something like an effort, you know, strive.
Right.
You have to strive for it. It is not that's going to land in your lap saying that you are a person of truth. So there will be times when you are challenged. And it will challenge perhaps your very survival.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why Swami says that you have to hold on to it as a penance. You have to hold it as a higher purpose or a higher value to stand to.
Right.
Right. So that's why it's very important to like weigh every word, you know, that when Swami says it's a
true
penance and not a virtue. Right. Because then there is something higher calling that is required than merely extolling it as a virtue. Right.
In fact, Swami starts by saying the among all the disciplines. That's what discipline itself means, something that you make effort to follow.
Right.
Right. It's not something which is very natural to you. You take it on yourself.
Absolutely.
And in the second padyam, Swami went on to speak about how these values and ideals of Indian culture are being eroded by taking on cultures which are foreign to this land.
Hmm.
And I think this was made clear by in the paragraph which Swami started the discourse with, where he spoke that, you know, every country has its own relevant knowledge.
Hmm.
And it holds forth that knowledge for a particular reason.
Right.
So you, living in this Indian culture, I mean, being given the fortune of being born in this Indian land, it does not, it's not a good thing for us to blindly absorb values and virtues from outside.
Right.
You know, however valuable they may be in that land, to be taken into this land without considering, you know, what is already here is not the right thing to do.
Right. And in fact, I think we could have added this last time also. I was thinking that if you look at even from the management point of view, we study this when we talk about mergers and acquisitions.
Mm-hmm.
So most mergers and acquisitions, they take place, they're analyzed at a financial level.
Okay.
Saying like these are the benefits that will accrue out of, you know, so many assets come together and you know, all those synergies that will happen. So those are the buzzwords you'll hear. And then later the merger happens and before you know it, you know, the whole thing has already broken apart. And we read that one of the things that people keep missing is also the compatibility of culture. So this is what happens. Even if a company has been thriving and then you try to import another culture, and in that disruption, most of the time, instead of it working for the good, most of the time the essence of what that company was could be innovation, could be like a culture of being employer friendly or customer friendly. So those things which form the core of what that company was, those get destroyed during that merger. And then, like, the company itself, you know, the foundation has been destroyed, it begins to automatically crumble. So on paper it looked very good, but these things not having been taken care of destroys the whole company itself.
In fact, we were making a reference to that acronym which Swami uses,
manager.
In the, where the alphabet N stands for nature of nations.
So
Swami would say that to his business students that, you know, when you start a venture or when you're trying to work in a company, it's very important to even take into account the nature of the nation in which that company is you know, functioning in. It's a very important thing. And of course, the other statement which would very often come when Swami is speaking about Indians and Indian value, Bharatiya culture, Swami said it's like an elephant which is unaware of its own strength, and such is the state of our countrymen today. In fact, Swami would often say this, a small elephant, even a small elephant, a baby elephant is quite strong compared to our strength. And they would say that when an elephant is small, they would chain it. They would put a chain around its legs. So the elephant grows with that belief that it cannot move from that spot because it's chained. They say that after the elephant has grown to its full size, you don't need a chain. Even a small rope, which you and I can snap it off, even that is good enough to hold the elephant, because the elephant thinks that it is tied and it can never move.
Yes, because if you actually go to their natural habitat, so, you know, in near Ooty, there's the Mudumalai forest, where I've seen, you know, the elephants that are wild, you know, they have somehow walked into human habitations, destroyed them. So they're all captured and caged, and I know the kind of fortification that is required. And the you can see that anger in their eyes. They're capable of destroying anything in front of them. So actually it takes a heck of a lot of effort, and they are aware of their strength.
Right.
And this is the thing when Swami says, you know, the strength. Now, the strength over here doesn't mean the physical power. There's a lot of spiritual power. And which, of course, Swami, in the rest of the discourse, he begins talking about what is present. But you're absolutely right, because the moment our focus has now shifted towards the, you know, the what the Western society values, it values achievement. It values like fortune and wealth above everything else. It values individualism, for example, right? But as we pointed out the last time, these are values that have grown organically, right? And here we have a culture where a lot of harmony, right? It's that is part, bedrock of human culture is harmony with nature, harmony with people around, right? And again, as we'll see over here, it is a culture that values dharma over other pursuits like wealth and attainments, etc. The first and foremost, according to this culture, is dharma. So there is now a lot of, therefore, confusion, right? So what we tend to do is therefore to ignore these, right? So let's say the reading of the Ramayana, say the reading of the Mahabharata, or the reading of the Shastras or the Upanishads. Now that is left behind because now we have in front of us a different set of goals. Right, and that is why it's very important to recognize or balance them out. It's not to say like stick to one or stick to the other, but there is a very important need to balance them out. So which is what Swami is talking about when you say you're unaware of your own strength, because hidden behind you have all this, which of course Swami will tell the reasons why do we need to dip into the epics, why do we need to dip into the dharma shastras.
In fact, Swami makes that statement there. He says unbridled freedom is a dangerous sword. It's literally something which an idea which has come from, I think there's another Sammakosha discourse where Swami makes this point. He says the idea of liberty is corroding the principles of Bharatiya culture. Because even as you're making a reference to Ramayana, I think all of these stories suggest that You seek happiness, you seek that kind of bliss within the mesh of your duties and your what binds you.
Yeah, that is where it is to be found.
Right. It is not in breaking free from all of that.
Exactly. Yeah.
And now, of course, we are always talking about freedom of speech. Yeah. And Swami would often, the greatest example of what the Indian culture wants you to follow is that sentence which says, satyam bruyat, priyam bruyat, satyam apriyam na bruyat. It almost gives you no option. Better not speak at all. Because that's how careful you have to be. You have the complete freedom to say what you can say.
Right.
But the greater you are, if you're able to say without hurting anybody.
Yes.
If you're able to put across your views without harming anybody and hurting anybody's feelings.
Correct.
I think that is gone. Now I think they're even talking about the freedom to offend. I think that's a term which is being spoken about now.
Yes, definitely some reconciliation is required.
Right, absolutely. And the ability to be ourselves, be happy with ourselves, in spite of being under the binds of dharma and duty.
Like being nasty is not something that is licensed by liberty. Right.
And the next padhyam was a very interesting padhyam where Swami is talking about all the actions that we do are purely for the sake of filling this belly of ours. And the kind of things which Swami makes a reference in that context, I think we also spoke about it last time when we were discussing this, where Swami also includes things like performing charity and sacrifices ceaselessly, also part of acquiring knowledge, power, harnessing crops and ruling over lands. Now, we would rather think that those are special activities or those are superior activities.
Yeah.
But Swami is saying even performing charity and sacrifice ceaselessly is a means of fulfilling the stomach. So I think anything which is done, even with a long-term view of benefiting the body, it still comes under an activity which is only to fill the stomach. It may not be like immediate pleasure, but even pleasure which is meant for afterlife or the next birth, even that includes as something which you do only for stomach.
Correct.
Or for filling your belly.
Right. And the converse statement, if you see in the Dharmavahini, Swami writes that it doesn't actually matter what are the actions that you are performing or what duties that you are performing, but if it is in the service of the Atma Dharma, right? That with the ultimate conviction that all this is divine, right? That time he says your actual duties which you perform, and this is upheld even by the stories which we hear in the Upanishads, and so we see that they extol a butcher who is performing his duty.
The Dharma Vyada.
Yes, the butcher is performing his duty, and yet he is considered as the enlightened one. Simply because of this, that his adherence to his duty and the detachment with which he performs something that is so disgusting as a profession as being a butcher. But just by the dint of the fact that he is, performs his duty to his parents and does his everyday duties with complete diligence, and that itself accords him the spiritual powers that the yogi is trying to develop by doing severe austerities.
Right.
Yeah. So that is one thing that very beautiful small little vignettes that will help us reconcile our own, you know,
right,
in our everyday life, the kind of naughty situations we get into. So these are all so much, as you said, no, all of these are the treasure that is present already.
And then Swami goes on to say in that same series of padyams which you were saying, that, I mean, these are all for the sake of the body.
Exactly.
And if you don't go beyond this, if man does not strive to reach the goal, he is inferior to other living beings. Swami does not say that he is like another animal. Swami says you become inferior to other living beings.
Right.
Like Swami would say this, you know, if an ignorant man or if an unlettered man does something which is unacceptable in society, people will be fine with it. I mean, people will not criticize him too much, because after all, he does not know, he is ignorant. But Swami would say a learned man, a person of knowledge, if he misbehaves in society, I mean, he will be looked down upon more than probably that unlettered man.
Right.
I think that is the case here, because Swami is saying that being born human, having this ability, if you do not utilize it, and if you still stick to serving only the body, you reach a state which is actually inferior to other living beings.
Yes.
And from there on, Swami goes to this very important part where Swami says that all types of learning which belongs to every country, there are these things which are emphasized in the process of that learning. Morality, ethics, truth, sacrifice, and forbearance are present in all of these types of education.
Yes.
And then Swami says the Bharatiya tradition of education, apart from imparting all of these, also imparts, Swami says, acharam, or the way of behaving in society, sampradayam, or it is, I think, translated as culture. I think sampradayam more pertains to following a tradition which has been set by elders. And Swami speaks of matam, or religion, and art, or kala, and jnana. Swami refers to all of these things. It's very interesting. In fact, even acharam, what we spoke about, the ability to follow your duties in the station of life that you are in is given a lot of importance. That's why Swami says it's always emphasized. On one hand, you've been taught the Advaitic philosophy, but that does not free you from the duties that you're meant to perform in the station of life you are in.
Right.
And of course, Swami speaks about sampradayam. Again, that is I think very important thing if you see in Indian culture, in fact any other ancient culture which has stood the test of time, the ability to accept the wisdom of elders. Not completely, but to an extent, I mean, even if you want to change it constructively, it starts from accepting it with reverence. I think that's what Swami would often say, that, you know, the sampradayam has actually lived, and it is even adapted itself to time, because it has been reverentially accepted and then changed.
Right. The adaptation is like a change from inside.
Absolutely.
After having practiced it, and then, because hidden behind that tradition is a certain, like, a thought, or as you said, a wisdom has gone into it. Like it has been a lot of sifting has taken place before we have arrived at it. And again, like, I'm reminded, you know, a person, he was speaking about how his experience as, like, being a same manager in a company, and you have a new recruit.
Mm-hmm.
So they say sometimes the new recruit, what they think, that having done an MBA and all the degrees, that it is now their work, having been recruited, to advise the manager on how to run the company, or the MD on how to run the company. So whereas the processes have all been set, and they're of course meant to be, you know, improved upon, but after you follow it and understand like why the process has been set in place. So he was very humorously telling that so the young recruits come in and they look around the office and they say, you know, oh, you got to change these curtains, right? Whereas I'm asking him to do this particular work. They're giving me advice on what decor the office should have, and that's not what I'm paying them for, right? So much the same way, like, so it is pretty much, as you said, constructive adaptation, and that has happened in Indian religion, in Hindu religion throughout. Right, from time to time there has been disruption, there has been change and acceptance of what is not working, removing that and putting in, I mean, going back to the core, going back to the essence of what the religion is. So that is a process that has happened time and again, right? And I think that is also the reason why it has withstood you know, 4,000 years, 5,000 years. Like, that is the reason why this Sanatana Dharma has stood the test of time. Because of its ability to adapt and keep going back to the essence of what it stands for.
In fact, even if you look at the lives of avatars, now we look at them as avatars and we look at them in a traditional manner.
Mm-hmm.
But if we historically study them, they were all actually path breakers.
Mm.
You know, they came to change some traditions, be it the episodes of Krishna saying that, why do you have to worship Indra? You know, where a reiteration of what a certain practice is meant to do, and if it does not serve that purpose, it is all right to give it up and start a new process. And that's what Rama did in many ways. And that's what Krishna does. And I think every avatar or every Mahapurusha who comes in that lineage is meant to literally refurbish the traditional belief systems.
Exactly. If you look at even the life of Adi Shankaracharya,
he
came in at a time when the religion, Hindu religion, had kind of devolved into just ritualistic and practices and sacrifices, which are abhorrent to many people, you know, at that time. So that this was a time when Buddhism, Jainism, these were all born, and it was felt by many people that the essence of the religion is now at stake.
Right.
And that was then at a time, it was at this time that Adi Shankaracharya, he starts this entire movement, like reviving the Upanishadic and the Advaitic way of thinking.
Right.
Not sacrificing devotion at that altar.
Right.
He, so the other, you know, the elements that had accrued, which were not actually in conformance with the religion, so those were excised. But what remained was something so beautiful. You know, you can see the religion again begin to flourish, and nothing was lost. Neither the devotional aspects nor the aspects of jnana were lost. So everything remained intact. But the accession of something that had accrued, which is not part of the original thought. Right.
The next part of that discourse, I think the clip which we played last time around was about Swami making references to the scriptures or the epics which have always inspired people of this land, the Mahabharata and Ramayana. And Swami was making a reference to how the authors, Vyasa and Valmiki, hold high a person who seems to be lesser intellectually, not intellectually, attainments wise, or Swami speaks about Rama being, Swami would often say this, the amount of expertise which Ravana had was far superior to even that of Rama. But Swami says how Rama is the protagonist, and that is the reason for that is his adherence to Dharma. In the same way, in the Mahabharata, the Pandavas spent most of their life in the forest, most of the time as people who were treated badly. But Swami says that they were extolled over the Kauravas, who were pretty much the on the ruling side most of the time. And the reason is because they represented Dharma. In fact, Swami makes a very beautiful point in the other discussion which we are having in the afternoons. Swami speaks about that episode which happens in the Kaurava court, the dishonoring of Draupadi. But Swami says, who actually fell in the eye of people? Though it appeared in the scene, you know, the Pandavas are sitting there, their crowns are taken off and they've lost everything. So Swami says, who has actually fallen? It's not the Pandavas who have fallen, the Kauravas have fallen. Everybody knew till then that these people were cruel, but that was the day when actually they showed how cruel they can be, how low they can stoop. So Swami says that scene is a sign of how much the Kauravas have fallen, and in everybody's eyes, Pandavas rose. Because Yudhishthira was so stable and so balanced even under that amount of injustice. And he was able to contain all his brothers through his righteousness. So that's a very beautiful way of looking at it. And that's what Swami is again emphasizing here. That why were these epics all the time extolling people who probably appeared like losers in our eyes? The reason is because they were superior in values, right? I think that was the part which Swami spoke of last time, and Swami again spoke a little about the Ramayana, little more about that, and how Rama is a representative of Dharma, which Swami would often say, Ramo Vigravahan Dharma.
Yes.
And I think that was where we left off last week,
right?
Last time. So should we go to the next clip and we'll see what Swami has to say there.
మానవ జీవితమునకు చతుర్విధ పురుషార్థములు ప్రధానమైనటువంటి యొక్క సూత్రములు
For the human life, the four purusharthas or goals, dharma, artha, kama and moksha, are the important principles.
Asutrama yendu kudanu motta modati dharmame tadupare artha kamamulu.
In those principles too, the first and the foremost is dharma. Artha and kama, that is, wealth and desires, come later.
Dharmamunu artha kamamunu anusarinchinappude avi kudanu sarthakam avutayi kani dharmamunu visarjinchi artha kamamunu matram anubhavinchatam cheta ivi kevalamu shobhanu kaligistayi.
When artha and kama, which is pursuit of wealth and desires, follow the path of dharma, they would get sanctified. On the contrary, bereft of dharma, following artha and kama would lead to suffering.
Karuka artham kudanu dharmamayamai untundali mana vanchalu kudanu dharmamayamaitiga undali appude manam aashinchukane mochamu manaku labhyam avutundi ani purushartamulu manaku chakkaga prabodhistu vachayi.
So the purusharthas expounded so well that even the wealth should be infused with righteousness. Even our desires should be infused with righteousness. Only then we get liberation even without asking for it.
Kani inati duradrishtavasattu bharatiyulu dharma artha kama mochamu ee nalugu vidhamaina purushartamulo dharmam anekunte padamulanu mocham ane sirasunu khandinchi artha kamamunane mondanu pattukoni kevalamu jeevitanni gadaputunnaru.
But unfortunately, Indians today, out of the four purusharthas, they have chopped the feet and the head, which represent dharma and moksha respectively. Instead, they are holding on to the trunk, which is headless, and living their lives with artha and kama. This is the reason India is facing all types of suffering today.
ఈ ధర్మమును విస్మరించటం చేతనే ధరణి కేవలము ఒక ధర్మహీనమైనటువంటి యొక్క రూపాన్ని ధరిస్తూ ఉండాలి అనేక కష్టములకు దుఃఖములకు విచారములకు గురి అవుతూ వస్తుండాలి.
Since this dharma is forgotten, earth is wearing a form of unrighteousness and is going through innumerable difficulties, sorrow and grief.
కనుక ఇలాంటి పరిస్థితుల్లో ధర్మమును ఉద్ధరించి ధర్మములకు మూలాధారమైనటువంటి యొక్క విజ్ఞానమును కూడా మనం పోషించి తిరిగి మన భారతదేశమును ధర్మ పునరుద్ధరింపు చేయడానికి తగిన కంకణం కట్టుకోవాలి.
సో అండర్ సచ్ సర్కమ్స్టాన్సెస్ వీ షుడ్ రిజాల్వ్ టు రిస్టోర్ ధర్మ, ఫాస్టర్ ఎడ్యుకేషన్ విచ్ ఇస్ ద సోర్స్ ఆఫ్ ధర్మ అండ్ దస్ రివైవ్ ద గ్లోరీ ఆఫ్ ఇండియా అగైన్.
భగవద్గీత ఎందు కూడాను ప్రారంభంలోనే ధర్మక్షేత్రే కురుక్షేత్రే సమవేతాయుత్సవ అనేక మందిని భగవద్గీత యొక్క సారాంశం ఏమిటని ప్రశ్నించినప్పుడు ఇది కర్మం చాలా ప్రధానమని, యోగం చాలా ప్రధానమని, జ్ఞానం చాలా ప్రధానమని, భక్తి చాలా ప్రధానమని అనేక మంది అనేక విధములుగా కూడాను ఈ భగవద్గీతను చక్కగా వ్యాఖ్యానం చేస్తూ వచ్చారు.
ఇన్ ద గీతా టూ ఇట్ ఇస్ సెడ్ రైట్ ఇన్ ద బిగినింగ్, ధర్మక్షేత్రే కురుక్షేత్రే సమవేతాయుత్సవ. మెనీ వెన్ క్వశ్చన్డ్ what's the essence of Bhagavad Gita, say, action is important, wisdom is important, devotion is important. Thus many have been explaining the Bhagavad Gita very well in so many ways.
ఒక్క స్వరూపాన్ని మనం నిరూపించవరనంటే పాదములు తల చాలా ప్రధానం. పాదములు తలనే మనకు చిక్కకుండా పోయినప్పుడు మొండిని ఏమాత్రం కూడా మనం నిర్ణయించలేము.
To identify one form, feet and head are very important. Without recognizing the feet and the head, we cannot decipher with the trunk of the body.
కనుక మొట్టమొదటి ధర్మక్షేత్రే కురుక్షేత్రే సమవేతాయుత్సవ మామక పాండవాశ్చైవ కిమకురవత సంజయ అనే ప్రథమ శోకములో ప్రథమ అర్థములో ప్రథమ ఒక్క వచనము ధర్మం.
సో ఇన్ ద ఫస్ట్ శ్లోక ఆఫ్ ద భగవద్గీత ద ఫస్ట్ వర్డ్ ఈజ్ ధర్మ.
అంత్య 700 శ్లోకములో కరెక్ట్ కనపడది ఎత్ర యోగీశ్వర కృష్ణ ఎత్ర పార్థో ధనుర తత్ర శ్రీ విజయోద్భూతి ధ్రువానీతిర్ మతిర్ మమ. కడపటి శ్లోకములో కడపటి పదము మమ.
రైట్ ఇన్ ద ఎండ్ ఇన్ ద 700th వర్స్ ద లాస్ట్ వర్డ్ ఇన్ ద శ్లోక ఇస్ మమ.
ఈ రెండింటిని మనం చేర్చినప్పుడు మమ ధర్మ అనేటువంటిది భోజించు వచ్చింది.
When we combine these two, we get mama dharma or my duty, which is the lesson it imparted.
కనుక ప్రతి వ్యక్తికి కూడాను తమ తమ ధర్మములను తమ గుర్తించి వర్తించడం అత్యవసరమని కూడాను ప్రబోధిస్తూ వచ్చింది.
So Gita has propagated and taught that every single individual should recognize their dharma and behave accordingly.
గృహస్థుడు గృహస్థ ధర్మమును, వానప్రస్థుడు వానప్రస్థ ధర్మమును, సన్యాసి సన్యాసి ధర్మమును, బ్రహ్మచారి బ్రహ్మచారి ధర్మమును ప్రవర్తించాలి.
A householder should follow his dharma. Likewise, a recluse, a renunciant and celibate should follow their respective dharma.
ఇది ఎవరికి తగినటువంటి ధర్మం వారిదే కాని ఒకరిదొకరికి ఏమాత్రం కూడా చెందుటకు వీలు కాదు.
Each one's dharma is their own and it's impossible that it could be exchanged with each other.
ఈ విధమైనటువంటి నియమములను పాటించుకుంటూ ప్రబోధించుకుంటూ ప్రచారం సల్పుతూ వచ్చింది.
Such restrictions were followed, taught and propagated by the Gita.
అన్నింటికీ మూలాధారమైనటువంటి మను ధర్మ. ఈ మను ధర్మమునకు మించినటువంటి యొక్క ధర్మము ఎక్కడ కూడాను ప్రపంచంలో కూడాను కానరాదు.
మను ధర్మ, the code of dharma as laid down by Manu, is the basis for everything. One cannot find any other dharma in this world which could surpass Manu dharma.
ఒకానొక సమయం లోపల ఫ్రోడెరిక్ నీచ్ అనేటువంటి జర్మనీ వేదాంతి,
once upon a time a German scholar named Nietzsche,
ఇతను సంకల్ప శక్తి అనేటువంటి గ్రంథాన్ని రాస్తూ ఉండినాడు.
He was writing a book on willpower.
దీని రాస్తూ ఉండే సమయం లోపల అతని అదృష్టవశాత్తు ఈ మను చరిత్ర అనగా మను ధర్మం అతనికి చిక్కింది.
When he was writing this book, fortunately he found the manu dharma.
దానిని చూస్తూ చూస్తూ తాను పొందినటువంటి ఆనందము వర్ణనాతీతమైనటువంటిది.
The joy he derived merely by going through it was inexplicable.
తదుపరి తాను రాస్తున్నటువంటి గ్రంథమును పక్కకు పెట్టాడు.
Later he kept aside the book he was writing.
భారతదేశములో గగన సీమ లోపల సూర్యుని వలె ప్రకాశిస్తున్నటువంటి ఈ మను ధర్మములకు ముందు నేను రాసేటువంటి ఈ గ్రంథము కేవలం క్యాండిల్ లైట్ వంటిది అనుకున్నాడు.
He thought to himself that in the holy land of Bharat, in front of the manu dharma which is shining forth like a sun in the sky, the book which I am writing is like a mere candle light.
మనకు గ్రంథము ఈ ప్రపంచంలోనే కానరాదన్నాడు.
He said, one cannot see any other book beyond this one in this world.
So that was the next clip in that discourse. Of course, it has been retranslated, and the voice that you heard was of Brother Sunil of Radio Sai. Swami continues from where we were mentioning that Swami spoke about Ramayana and how Rama was an embodiment of Dharma, and Swami takes on from there and speaks of the four Purusharthas: Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha. I think the interesting point about Indian culture is, you know, these are Purusharthas. These are not goals of a spiritual life. These are not goals of a spiritual aspirant. These are Purusharthas. If you're born a human being, these have to be your goals. And I think in another discourse, Swami makes that point, that in the modern context, we think that a worldly person does not need to worry about moksha and dharma. A worldly person can fill his life with artha and kama. And similarly, they think a spiritual person does not have to worry about artha and kama. He only has to worry about, you know, dharma and moksha. And that splitting of these four purusharthas as spiritual and worldly is the cause for much confusion and problem. I think that's what Swami is making a reference to here also, where he says that dharma should be the basis on which even artha and kama is pursued. And very, very powerfully Swami says that if one lives like that, he can attain liberation even without asking for it or even without seeking for it. like what you were making a reference to, the story of Dharma Vyada. Now, somebody who is leading his life in that dharmic fashion and pursuing his life's whatever needs are there in one's life through the prism of Dharma, he need not even ask for that highest understanding. It comes unasked.
And, you know, speaking about how Swami is saying, you know, that the pursuit of wealth and desire are to be in accordance with the Dharma. And he gives a reason also that unless it is done that way, they cause grief.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the Manusmriti, we find exactly the same reason given. It is not, to limit not to take away from you that desire for wealth or that desire for kama, but more to regulate it within certain lines. Right? And the reason is, again, not to impose on you restrictions just for the sake of it. But behind that is a concern that when you do not follow this path, there are, of course, other ways of getting at wealth. There are a lot of ways in which you can indulge yourself in pleasure, but at the end of it lies grief. Right, but so that's why this is like a prescription that is given, and the prescription has come with a lot of thought. Like again, when you look at Manusmriti, is a distillation of a lot of sutras. You know, Dharma sutras have while we hold Manusmriti as one of the cardinal books of Dharma, but actually it is a distillation of several Dharma sutras which have been in prevalence. They say that you could begin with the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad as one of the sources of Dharma in Indian culture, right?
Okay.
Of course, the Gita is would be a cardinal text again, but you would begin with the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, right? And then down to all of these principles that are like codified and written, like scenarios, like what to do in this particular situation, what about this situation, right? So those, but they're a distillation of what has already been spoken about before, and we should therefore understand that they stood the test of time, and we are talking about wisdom that spans centuries. If you see the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is one of the early Upanishads, right? And so down to that, there has been a continuity of thought. There's been evolution of thought also, like down so many centuries, and that is what we find as the Manusmriti. So, and the reason is very clear. It is laid down almost right at the beginning that this is what we have as our goal, that you avoid grief, you know, by once you contravene what has been spoken about, the natural tendency is to therefore to, you know, spiral towards doom. Right. And one more thing it makes very clear, the Manusmriti, is that, and Swami also says this, that he who recognizes that the universal soul exists in all beings, becomes equal-minded towards all and enters the highest state of Brahman. So, dharma is laid down also as a sadhana. That it is, this is also a path of sadhana. You follow the path of dharma, right? You need not, you know, like if you are not capable of intellectual this thing, like understanding of what jnana is and what advaita is, they say you follow the path of dharma and this understanding will come to you that it is the universal soul that exists in all beings. And in fact, Swami in the Dharma Vahini again, he says this, that what is dharma is actually the acts that are born out of your being immersed in the atmic bliss. And hence it is a reverse, you know. So what we do is, therefore we always try to follow the path of dharma so that we are in consonance with, you know, us being of divine provenance. Right? So that is the reason why dharma is laid down. So there is, so it's very important to understand, like in our present society, that what is the concern that lies behind such dharma sutras, right? Such codes. Not for the sake of restriction, not for any reason to limit your thinking or your dream of like what you want to achieve in your life. They're not taking away your springboards for whatever reason, right? But they're setting the guides within which, you know, you can travel safely to whatever goal you have set for yourself.
Right. And you know, one thing which we have to remember, especially when you're saying that, you know, it comes from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is supposed to be one of the oldest texts,
right,
to, you know, hundreds of years of it's not purely intuitive alone, because much of it comes from intuition. I think when you go through these texts, it comes from a lot of very, very scrupulous observation.
Yeah.
You know, you're looking at people constantly and saying, what happens? You
Beautiful.
Know, somebody
yes.
has done this, what happens? Somebody tells a lie. How his nature changes once he makes bold to do one crime? You know, how, in fact, there is this debate about, if I'm getting the word right, consequentialism.
Mm.
Where they speak about ethics and consequentialism.
Yes.
They say that depending on the consequence, the ethics of that moment is decided.
Correct.
When I think the classic example they give is about, will you stop a train which is going to kill five people by sacrificing one person, by pushing that person?
Classic trolley problem.
Right, the trolley problem and pushing a person off the bridge. And you being able to, you know, switch a lever and do that, and by pushing a person manually, and how people's thing changes. In fact, whenever they speak of that example, they say that we exclude what happens to a person who has made bold to do that one act. Because they say, once you have done it, and you tend to rationalize that in other scenarios too, which you actually avoid so that you can speak only about this scenario. And if you look at the Manusmriti, and of course I have not gone through much of it, there's one particular verse where they talk about how do you stick to this principle of speaking truth. So there are many, many nitty-gritties given there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you speak untruth, where it is okay to tell a lie.
Mm.
And I mean, the permutations and combinations are actually mind-blowing there.
Mm-hmm.
I think that must have come with such an observation. You know, where a person, if the nature of the person is such and such, he can tell a lie and not go into that adharmic path after that. Or a person who tells a lie and gets away, gets tempted to, you know, take recourse and lies every other time. So the way that goes, it's actually very, very confusing. And in fact, that's why Swami says in the Dharma Vahini that, you know, to be able to pick out the right dharma to do among the many paradharmas which you have, or the deha dharmas which you have. Because Swami would say that you're a son, you're a husband, you're at the same time a person who is working in the society, you're
exactly.
a neighbor.
Yeah.
And when put in a situation to choose which is the dharma that you have to follow at that point, needs a lot of intellectual, probably you should have mastered the Manodharma. That's why even in the Mahabharata, they speak of Vidura as somebody who is a master of dharma.
Mm-hmm.
That even Bhishma would turn to him, that in this situation, tell me what is the right thing to do.
Yeah.
And Vidura would tell that, you know, this is what has to be done.
Yeah.
So, it's impossible for us to really tell what is the right thing to do. And that's why Swami says that at any time to follow the Atma Dharma is the right thing to do. And Swami would say that's nothing but listening to your conscience.
Mm.
And that again goes back to what you were saying, that it all comes from the idea that divinity is within me.
Mm.
And Swami, I think in the discourse where Swami spoke about the three forms of divinity, Swami said Avyakrita also has the name of Antarvani. And Swami says, it's the voice within. So it all comes from the belief that divinity is within me, and if I were to seek guidance from within, it is there to be found.
Yes.
Right?
And sometimes the guidance that comes, you know, so when you see, one of the things is that what my dharma is right now is actually is a form of inquiry in itself, right? So there's no single answer to it. Like
exactly.
Like if somebody asks us, gives a situation that they are, or a predicament that they are, and asks us what we have to do, we are absolutely clueless, right? Because we may know what we would do
right.
in that situation, because it's a very nuanced, very intricate answer, right? And sometimes the answer that we get is not something that we would like. Right? The answer may be something very unpleasant as to what we have to do in this particular situation. Now, one way of resolving that, like if we see from the behavioral science point of view, like in the book Thinking Fast, Thinking Slow by the Nobel Prize winning economist Daniel Kahneman. So he speaks about how, let's forget neuroscience and keep all of that out, but if you just look at the brain, the way it functions, you got a system 1 and a system 2. He says, like the system one would be your gut reaction,
right?
Like what comes straight from
exactly.
the limbic brain, and it has its place because that is what we need in very, very, it needs a fast and quick response. Right, and it has its merits. Right, you say you're faced with a situation of survival. Right, at that minute, moment, you cannot keep thinking about okay, what is the right thing to do at this time? What is the right You have to take action right then and there.
Exactly.
Right, and that is what the it is given for. So the immediate gut reactions, which most of us have, there are things what we speak about as triggers. Right, now somebody says something. Right, we are triggered. Or somebody does something at a distance, like a car that cuts in front of us. There's a certain trigger which most of the time we are not in control of, right? And that he sets aside and calls that as a system one response, right? And which is pretty good for the early forms of mankind, because that is a kind of environment in which
based on survival,
completely based on survival, right? And that's the limbic brain, which is giving you all of that, right? Then he calls the system two, because the system one is very, very error prone, right? In reading a situation, right? In its response to situations, it's highly error prone. Most of the times we feel when we read something, somebody says something that attacks our belief. Our first reaction is to go after that person, shout at them, ad hominems, the reactions that we see. That our gut tells us that is a right response. Correct. He calls that as a therapeutic response and not the strategic response.
Okay.
So the strategic response has to come from your system two. So the system two is like where you actually weigh consequences. It's a lot slower. And he says that present society, it needs a lot of system too. And that has to be something that has to be, we have to educate ourselves to give credence to system two than system one. And system two is where dharmic evaluations,
right.
That is where you get in touch with, what we really need to do. Because otherwise, the human being that you are will come up with a very quick response as to what you have to do. And that may completely violate your dharma. Right, whereas the system two, like for example, like you, let's say that the dharma called taking care of your parents. Right? So for many, now that becomes a very, a difficult situation, right? What am I going to lose out when I have to do these acts, right, in terms of time lost or money lost, right? A lot of people can make that decision because they've kind of slowed down their thinking process and have thought over the whole thing. And then they come to that conclusion, yes, I need to serve my parents and that is a very, very important dharma for me. Right? And which is why the answer may be very unpleasant. You ask that question of yourself, if you brood over it, the answer that comes may be a very unpleasant answer, something that you don't like. And actually, that's where Swami points out that you're now looking at a door. Right, to go through. So if you choose dharma and you go through that door, like what lies at the other end? And Swami says, that your own divinity. And the Manusmriti also says that what you attain at the end is this, that you attain that understanding that is it is the one Atma that or the one Brahman that is existent in everyone. And you actually enter that state of Brahman. So those are the doors that you have to walk through.
Right. And what you spoke about, that system one and system two in place, it's actually a very, very important thing. In fact, there's a beautiful connection between what Swami started off with in that Padyam, where he said you have to go beyond just serving the body. I think that serving the body response always comes from that system one, the limbic system, always trying to preserve life.
Yeah.
Right. In fact, there's this, I think recently released English movie where about there are these travelers who are stuck in a cold forest and they're being hunted by a pack of wolves. When I was seeing that, I was wondering what would happen to our principles and values if we are in that position.
Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
Our being a stickler to being a vegetarian to I can't drink anything which is alcoholic. I wondered if put in a situation like that when you just have to do anything to survive, how much of these principles we will, hold on to and be ready to let go of the body.
Right.
I mean, of course, we can say that, no, I will still follow. But you never know what you will do then.
Correct.
Because that is a totally different scenario. I think that's why what Swami says is, what we've spoken of before too, like what happens to a sportsman, you know, that hundreds and hundreds of hours of practice which he puts in solitude is to make sure that the response which comes after thinking and, you know, a bowling machine is bowling to him and he's playing, that response comes instantaneously when he's seated in front, when he's playing in front of 1,000 people. It becomes a system one response now. You know, he does not have to think and play the shot. It just comes spontaneously. I think same thing happens even in the case of dharma. And many times if you see the difference between what we see in Indian societies today and probably in a much more wealthier society, morality is much more easier there than here. Because here it's a question of survival most of the time. In fact, there was this other discourse which we were going through. Very beautifully Swami says, I think it's a convocation discourse. So in that Swami says, I want all of you to overcome fear and I want you to go out and help people overcome fear. I think that's a very beautiful message which Swami is giving his students. Because as long as we are in fear, we'll always be responding from that system one thinking.
Correct. You know,
we'll always be trying to, we'll be under stress and we will be, as I said, in the forest trying to save our lives. So that time none of these values and morality actually mean anything. So Swami said, the moment you start removing fear from people, they will automatically become more dharmic.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah. Because when you were talking about fear, like I wanted to tie it in with what you were speaking before. A similar situation, an analogous situation, but perhaps more dire, is something that a soldier faces in the battlefield. And is fear not present? Fear is very much present. Like I've listened to these interviews of war veterans and we always come with that preconception that you're looking at a brave person. And that person says, you know, if you show bravado on that field, you'll not live to tell the tale. Right? So it is not, so the bravery, what we see as courage, is actually acting in the face of fear.
Right.
And that is a training that is given much before, you know, the everyday, the practice that you go to, go through. And the constant reinforcements of, now that is very important, the constant reinforcements of who a soldier is.
Right.
Right? Because you want to distinguish between a human being and you want to distinguish that from a soldier. Right? That is why you see constantly, like, who is a student? We have to inquire, keep inquiring, who is a student? Right, so you have to distinguish being a student as being a different form of being itself from your everyday existence.
Right.
So when you are a student, you are a kind of person. Right. Or when you are a teacher, you are a different kind of person. And highest stake is perhaps as a soldier. Right. When you are a soldier, you are a certain person. Right. And that if you go to a barracks, you know, as passing through Pathankot about 2-3 months ago, like Pathankot is one of India's like besieged you know, battalions all the time, and I was looking at all the kind of signs that they set up, constantly reinforcing courage in the face of fear, like how valor is placed above everything else, how service to the nation.
Right.
Ultimately, sacrifice. That service to the nation, that ideal is constantly reinforced because that is what makes a soldier who he is.
Right.
Right. That dedication to the nation is what distinguishes a soldier from the rest of civil society. Right. And therefore, dharma is something where you have to distinguish who you are being at that moment. Right. If you look at a mother, that's, they say, you know, classic examples of a mother that saves a child, you know, the mother finds strength from God knows where to do those actions, or the agility, something that is missing. But because what is acting at that moment is not human being. What is acting at that moment is a distinguished being called the mother.
Right.
Right. So that is what we have to understand. So that is why they keep, there is so much importance placed on your dharma. So Swami speaks about that. Who you are, you find yourself now by design or by destiny. You find yourself doing so many different roles, like as a father or as a mother, or as a son or as a daughter, as a husband or as a wife, an employer, as a, you know, parent. Right, all of these, by design or by destiny, these are roles that you have right now. And Swami says that, you know, you should not occupy your mind with shoulds and shouldn'ts. Right. At that moment, it is, you got to cognize, like, what is my duty, what is my dharma, and act according to that. And that's why, that is the thing, like, once we keep in mind that what lies at the, it is a sadhana, right? It is not an imposition on you, it is a sadhana.
Right.
And at the end of it, you know, there is the highest goal that is waiting for you.
Right. Yeah. And of course, Swami was talking about that Bhagavad Gita part where, you know, Swami says, take the first word in the, with which the Bhagavad Gita begins, and the last word with which it ends. Swami would say, Mama Dharma. I think what Swami would say is, as you're saying, it's very difficult for us to say that this is what the dharma is. I mean, forget about telling for others. It's difficult to tell for ourselves itself.
Yeah.
But probably the best place to start is to keep asking that question. You know, most often we don't even ask that question. You know, we are happy with what is the immediate response which comes, and we are happy to do that. And we say that, you know, I was triggered, I did it. Instead of saying that what I did was wrong, probably I should think and act. So that questioning, what am I supposed to do? I think that becomes more and more important. In fact, I was mentioning this in another program. The reason why we get confused with this inner voice and the voice of the mind is, the inner voice will only answer this question. What am I supposed to do now? He does not answer the question, how do I get out of this problem? Because when we often ask this question within ourselves, we're only asking, you know, how do I set right this mess I've made, or how do I get out of this problem? Answers to that question will only come from the mind.
Right.
But the question of, in this situation, what is the right thing I have to do? What am I supposed to do? As you said, most often the answer is quite unpleasant, something which we don't want to listen. So it is that question the conscience gives an answer to, and that is what dharma is.
Yeah. Also, you know, sometimes I wondered that if you look at the sequence in which these words come, you got dharma that comes first and then comes mama, right? And because the first question is that, you know, what is the what is my dharma? But the important word there actually is not dharma as much as mama. Right?
Like,
because in answering what your dharma is right now, you also have to answer the question as to who you are right now. Because that's a very important thing. If your answer comes that I'm a weak person battling for survival, then pretty much this is your, you know, the course of action. But if you say that like a soldier, right? A soldier says, I am a soldier. And the moment he says, I am a soldier, the moment he identifies himself with that distinguished being called a soldier, all rest of the actions are very clear. Like how Swami would say so many times, be clear, the rest will follow. So you got to be clear as to who you are. Like if you are a teacher, this is what you will do. And if you are the your divinity, this is what you will do. What is appropriate, right? So the answer is in that word called mama. Like you got to answer that question.
How you define that.
Yeah.
Right. I think we have time only for that much. We'll continue this discourse.
Sure.
And then we can tell it endless number of times. Each discourse of Swami is so profound. And I mean, the balance is so beautiful, more than anything else.
Precisely.
That you know, the balance between the esoteric knowledge of oneness and what we have to do in everyday life. And of course, we will see that definitely Swami will bring in bhakti somewhere. Because, you know, as Swami would say, life is not, loses its sweetness without that aspect of love for God and love for fellow beings.
Yeah, because there is a temptation, you know, when I look at, so discourse, so much has been said. And it is quite a thing, like, there is a dilemma called, do we go into sentence by sentence? Because looking at Swami, there's every word has been placed there with a certain intention in mind. And like, doing justice would mean actually going into the lanes and bylanes of what Swami has said, explore it, you know, to the best that we can. Or the other way is just skim over the surface of what Swami said.
Right, like, absolutely. So I'm sure a year later, if we go through the same discourse, it'll sound as new as anything.
Yeah.
I think that's what we feel from the many discourses we've heard.
Even when we review a section we spoke
about.
Absolutely,
exactly. Even when I'm going through the discourse which we spoke about a couple of weeks back, it sounds like so new and so much more to learn.
Yeah.
And so, dear listeners, thank you for joining us. And we do hope this program only inspires you to go and do the Shravanam, Mananam, Nityadhyasanam yourself. Because each one of us have to do this, because the greatest treasure that Swami has given us is His message in His own voice. So, offering our immense gratitude to Swami for that on behalf of all of us. Do join us again next week at 7:30 p.m. for the next episode and the continuation of this discourse. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu and his guests for the next episode and the final episode of this Thursday, the Vahini Satsang. Till we meet you next time, happy listening.